Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin, and with me is my co-host, the man they call Big Nasty, because he walks and talks and does exactly what he wants, Barry Rose. Barry, how are you doing today?
Good, and you're right, actually. That's gotten me fired from a lot of jobs and kicked out of a lot of restaurants and bars. So, Big Nasty. I'm going to go with that one today. But I'm doing great, man. How you doing?
You are the Angelo Mosca of podcasts, my friend. And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We'll break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. On this episode, after a dark episode last week, Barry, we're coming back into the light a little bit. Today, we're going to talk about two of my top 100 of the 80s, back to the wrestling theme for those of you that are fans of that particular, genre. We're going to talk a little about the life of the recently departed Paul Jones, number one. And then Barry and I are going to offer up our top five ice cream chains, and maybe we'll each throw in our top five ice cream flavors if you're a good audience. Before we get there, Barry, we have a few things to discuss. As Jerry Reed once said, we got a long way to go and a short time to get there. So, first of all, I want to mention that recently I was notified by our beloved producer, the great Brian Last. Barry, we crossed a certain threshold in the old download number, and I want to thank everybody out there because the reaction, particularly our last two shows, Barry, we got some great reactions on the tag team episode and on the Unsolved Murders and Mysteries episode.
Yeah, you know, that was really the tag team episode, too. I think if you're a wrestling fan, and certainly we were called on the carpet for missing a whole bunch of teams. And it is true. When I look and I go, how the hell didn't we mention the Von Brauners? It's one of those Homer Simpson moments. But the last week's episode with the Unsolved Mysteries was a really polarizing episode in the fact that some people absolutely said it was through the roof. And then we had the reaction of, I can't even listen to this. And not because it was bad. I mean, and maybe it was bad, but it was because it's such a, I guess it's such a topic that really taps into your nervous system. So I got to say, though, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed last week's episode so much that this week I was still following some of these stories on my own without even doing anything. I'm on the computer. I'm looking. And then, of course, Jeff, coincidental or not, and Rick Nathan, I want to give Rick Nathan a shout out. One of our faithful listeners came up with a great line. This week, the Golden State Killer was caught. Right after our episode aired, 48 hours, 72 hours later, the Golden State Killer is apprehended. And Rick Nathan says, breaking kayfabe is in harmony with the cosmos. And I just thought that was just the greatest thing ever. But, yeah, great episode. The last couple episodes have been so much fun to be a part of, you know. And that's one thing. You and I, above everything else, you and I are fans of this shit. We like talking about this. So this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's good to know that also regarding last week's episodes, apparently there are some people out there that are into some pretty dark, morbid shit, just like we are, Barry. And, certainly, I want to give a shout out to my friend Howard Baum, who sent us a couple links on some other unsolved murders and mysteries. And apparently, Howard likes to go down that rabbit hole that I described recently, too. Let's go back real quick, Barry, to the Golden State Killer, since we didn't touch on that. Real quick, for the uninitiated, for those who are listening outside the continental U.S., why don't you just give a quick background and a Reader's Digest version on the Golden State Killer, what happened there, and how they were able to catch him.
Yeah, so everything that I've been reading this week, too. So the Golden State Killer is an ex-cop. He was in two different police forces out in the California area, the state of California, and was a guy that was committing robberies, rapes, and murders. And apparently, as we learned, he was sometimes whispering the name Bonnie. This is for Bonnie. This is for Bonnie. So they were able to actually catch this guy, retired cop, 72, Joseph D'Angelo, and through a genealogy website, one of these websites where I guess you submit your DNA and they're able to somehow, tell you about people that you may be related to, and they can go back. And you know, it's really interesting. I learned a little bit this week because I didn't know this actually existed. And in doing so, they were tipped off apparently by one of his relatives that this would be somebody that you would want to keep an eye on and somebody that you may want to investigate. And they, I guess, like, staked out his house or did something, but they got a hold of his DNA. And by getting a hold of his DNA, they were able to match him up to one of the killers from, I think, in the early 70s, one of the murders of the early 70s. So it's a riveting story. When you see the guy, you see that, you know, he's aged. He looks every bit 72 years old. But I think we're going to see more with this case start to unravel and really start to learn more over the next few weeks as well.
Yeah, this case started, I want to say the years, it's between like 1976 and 1988, somewhere like about a 12-year window, and just a super, super creepy, creepy storyline where the guy would commit rapes on these women and then a couple days later would call them and say, "I'm coming back to kill you." He'd whisper it into the phone. And there was a book that was written, Barry, I want to say it was called I'll See You in the Dark or something like that. Is that correct? The one that Patton Oswalt's
wife?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he apparently was, at the time the guy was arrested, very emotionally appeared on several different broadcasts. I want to say he was on Seth Meyers' program and was talking about a note that his wife had written for the last page of the book where she described what it was going to be like. It was like a note she had written to the killer. And this guy committed reportedly 12 murders, 45 rapes, and hundreds of break-ins. And she wrote a note describing, "This is what it's going to be like when the police come to your door and arrest you." And it was just absolutely riveting. Really great stuff. Glad to see that guy's off the street, even if he is 76 years old. He's playing the old man game, I got to tell you. He's now showing up in wheelchairs, and reportedly his neighbors are saying that's really interesting because he was outside, walking around the neighborhood or something like that, and now all of a sudden he needs a wheelchair. Speaking of guys playing the old man game, as I call it, Barry, I want to go on a little bit of a rant here about the recent Bill Cosby verdict. Folks, you want to talk about a scumbag? Let's talk about Bill Cosby. This guy is a serial rapist. I'm so glad he was convicted. The way that during a rape trial, victims are treated is completely horrific, and it absolutely infuriates me that the way these lawyers, and I work in the court system, I deal with lawyers every day, and folks, just like anybody else, there are good lawyers, there are bad lawyers, they're good police officers, bad police officers, but when you see an attorney attack a victim who has been sexually assaulted and battered by someone who's drugging her and taking advantage of her, whether it's actually physically having intercourse with her or digitally penetrating her, this guy, and that he plays off the I'm just a poor helpless old man, just absolutely infuriates me. And it's a shame, because of his age and how long this case dragged out, that this fucking scumbag probably won't end up having to do jail time. And that infuriates me, because I would love to see this guy get put into a prison cell, have his fingerprints taken, and have that door shut closed so that all those victims that he took advantage of will know that this mother effer is not going to ever.
You can say it.
This motherfucker is not going to ever see the light of day. I have no fucking sympathy for this guy. And I'll tell you this. I posted it on my, on a Facebook page. I loved Chet Kincaid. I loved Fat Albert. I didn't really ever get into his Cosby show when he was, good old Dr. Huxtable.
No, it sucked. Fat Albert was great, though.
I never saw a single episode of that show, as a matter of fact. But no, Fat Albert was absolutely genius. That was one of my favorite cartoons growing up as a kid. I loved him as Chet Kincaid, the phys ed teacher. But somewhere along this guy's life, his path took a real dark turn. And did this guy that sold himself as the paternal figure to Black America and to all of America, that he was doing all this stuff is completely infuriating. And oh my God, Barry, I could probably spend an hour talking about just how pissed off I am at this guy and how he's taken advantage of not only women, but of America and the mindset of young America, that he would have the nerve to sit there and say, "You should be living your life this way, like me," when he's doing all this stuff. F you, Bill Cosby. That's what I got to say. F you, Bill Cosby. Now, Barry,
that's our show this week, folks. We can just wrap that up right there. Yeah, it's but you know what? It's all going to get better from here. If that's how we're starting this week, let me tell you how we're going to fucking end this week, right? Wow.
So, before we get started, Barry, we got 1 month left until we go to Lutz, Florida.
Oh, my God. I didn't even think. You're 100% right. It was 5 weeks. It's 1 month. Absolutely. Yeah. Actually, if I look at the calendar, it's exactly 1 month. 1 month from Lutz. And we're doing well. Ticket sales are good. We've exceeded where we were with the previous two fan fests. We have a loaded roster of not only guys that were legends in the state of Florida as far as wrestling, but guys that are professional wrestling legends. You've got former NWA World's Heavyweight Champion, really one of the longest tenures in the history of the NWA, had the title for 4.5 years. We're talking about Dory Funk Jr. We also have Scott McGee. We've got the former Olympian Bob Roop will be there. Steve Kern Skinner, Fabulous Ones, part of that great tag team with Mike Graham, a guy who's done everything, a trainer, done everything in the business. Buddy Colt, former North American Heavyweight Champion, and a guy rumored many times to have been a future NWA World's Heavyweight Champion had he not been in a career-ending plane crash. And then Bill Alfonso, Fonzie himself, started off as a referee in the state of Florida, obviously became more well-known when he went to ECW, became a referee, and then was manager of Sabu and Rob Van Dam. So it is. It's June the 2nd, which is a month from today. In Lutz, Florida, at the Jeff, can you remember the name of the hotel?
It's
87 words. It's 87 words.
I can barely remember what happened yesterday. You're asking me to come up the name of that hotel name?
Marriott Residence Inn at Suncoast Parkway in Lutz, Florida. It's a great hotel. A lot of our out-of-town guests, if not all of our out-of-town guests, will be staying there. Plus, some of the wrestlers stay there, and it's an all-day event. It will start at 11:30 that day with our cup of coffee with Dory. It's limited to only 25 fans for that, and I think we only have 3 tickets left for that. But basically, 25 fans, Dory Funk Jr., a bunch of coffee, and Dory's going to tell stories for an hour. And it's obviously 25 fans, so it's a really, really limited audience. Then we go into our fan fest portion, which is photos, autographs, and then after that we'll do our awards banquet. We're going to induct Coach John Heath, who is a CWF legend, into the CWF Hall of Fame. Then we do our dinner, and the dinner has been just the last two dinners are one of those things, if you're a wrestling fan, that it's you never forget. It's one of these things that just will stay with you, and you'll go, man, that was really unbelievable. The first one, we had the Assassin and his son, Nick Patrick. Wrestlers were having so much fun, they decided to stick around, which was Bugsy McGraw and Dave Sierra. The second one was Kevin Sullivan and J.J. Dillon. And both of those dinners, where the food was fantastic, by the way, were moderated by...
Who?
You, sir, it was you. Jeff the Booker Baudrin moderated. And that second one it was over 2 hours. I remember it was like we hit the 2 hour mark, and I remember you're looking at me and I'm looking up at the clock, and then Penzer's looking at his watch. But hey, we're not cutting off our guests, and JJ and Kevin had the best stories. And we did not cut them off. So I know we went longer than 2 hours. And then we did something cool the last time, and we're going to do it again this time, and it was what we called the after party. We went into a room. It was JJ, Kevin, you and I were both there, and we had 20 fans, and we brought a bunch of liquor into the room, and we sat there. We drank. I didn't drink, but everybody else drank, and JJ and Kevin just spoke honestly, openly, and very, very candid to any questions that were being asked. And that was really a highlight. And I had a bunch of fans who've been watching since the 70s. They've been fans since the 70s. And they came up to me and they said, that is the highlight of anything wrestling related for me. I have never been a part of something like that. So we're going to do it again. Bob Roop is going to be leading this one, and we're going to have a special guest joining him as well. So this is a full day. It starts at 11:30 a.m. It ends at 11:30 p.m. It's 12 hours. You can do as much or as little as you want. If you want to do everything, there are only 3 tickets left, which will get you into the cup of coffee with Dory in the after party. So I encourage you, you can look at our page. I've posted the link there, Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry, or you can go on to the Facebook group, which is CWF Archives, or the CWF Legends Fan Fest Facebook page as well. So I'm looking forward to it, Jeff. I know, and I don't know if I even told you this, but I love Deed, and my doctor, when I saw him 3 weeks ago, a month ago, he said, you know, you've gained 11 pounds in a year. And I said, yeah, I eat a lot of fucking shit is why. So I've been trying to be really good the last couple of weeks, though I faltered at times. I had a donut for breakfast, but because when we get down to Tampa, Jeff, I am going to eat like no one's business. So whether it's Portillo's or whether we're doing gyros, whatever it is, I'm eating.
Okay, a couple things. First of all, I really resent the implication that you can ply wrestlers with some sort of alcoholic beverage to get them to talk. Who would have ever suspected that? Just unbelievable. I'm glad you mentioned Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry, the board. As we tried to tell a few people, we have a new group now that is being moderated. Dare I say, here's this name, folks, by the dreaded Travis Reigns. We want to thank Travis for moderating. There's your shout out, Travis. Now calm yourself down. Want to give a special shout out to Kevin Carter. Kevin, we had a discussion on the group about best breakup songs, best wedding songs, that kind of thing. And Kevin Carter created a Spotify list, which was above and beyond the Call of Duty. So, Kevin, I certainly want to give you a shout out. Thanks, Dad. Barry, I just want to say that you and Dave Penzer, I know, is really on. He's the guy on the ground there in the Tampa area and working hard at putting this event over. We want to say thanks to both of you for that. Now, before we get to our matches, a couple of quick things we want to mention and discuss real briefly. We recently lost Motoko Baba, who was the wife of Shoei the Giant Baba. And Dave Meltzer did a great obituary for Motoko, because Motoko, for those of you unaware, may have been the single most influential woman in the history of the wrestling industry. I'm talking above Fabulous Moolah, Linda McMahon. But, you know, what she did behind the scenes at All Japan Wrestling, you know, one of the things Dave said was they basically played a game of good cop and bad cop. And the Giant Baba was always the good cop. And Motoko, who some called the Dragon Lady, was the bad cop. She was the one that always would give the bad news, that would express her displeasure with the way something had played out. She was the one that really ran the merchandising aspect, things like that. And I'll never forget when I went over there in December of 1987, went to a spot show. They had the merchandising table, and they were merchandising, you know, way, way ahead of the some of the American companies. And we were there, and we began chit-chatting. You know, we're at a spot show, and we're literally the only 3 Americans that are in the crowd that night. And she sees us, calls us over, and she hands each of us a really, really sweet T-shirt of the Funk Brothers. And for many years, that was the highlight of any wrestling card I go to. People would see that and just completely freak out. Couple of anniversaries of some unfortunate passings. This week, 9 years since Buddy Rose passed. Buddy is a guy that we have spoken of often on this show, so we honor his memory. Chris Candido, 13 years ago.
Wow.
Did you ever get to see Chris Candido live?
Yeah, so I did. So, pardon me. So I saw Chris Candido, it's been 13 years, and I did. So I saw one of his last matches. I was working for Universal Studios in Orlando, and they were doing the filming there. And I actually, because I had management ID, I was able to get backstage. So I was able to walk around where they were, you know, the card where Jushin Liger was there. I was able to go up to Jushin Liger and shake his hand, which was a huge deal. But Candido was there, and I was able to see one of his last matches before he died. Chris was, you know, it's such a sad, sad story in so many ways, and especially so much has, I guess, been revealed after the fact with his relationship with Sonny, with Tammy Sitch. And, you know, here was a guy that obviously had made a shitload of mistakes, a ton of mistakes, but was getting his life cleaned up and was sober and by all accounts was doing a great job, and to die of, you know, of a blood clot I believe he had gotten a broken leg, if I'm correct, and it was a blood clot, and it killed him. It's just that's really, really sad. You know, it's like when you hear like Sam Kinison being killed by a drunk driver. You know, it's like, you know, a guy that, you know, had been all over the place and so much had gone wrong, and here he's on the road to, you know, to something good, and he's working steadily again, and then to die like that. It's just really, really sad. Candido was great though, and he was the tagline he always used, no gimmicks needed. And it was true. You know, he was just a really, really good performer. And to use an old cliche, he was one of these guys, in my opinion, if he had been 4, 5, or 6 inches taller, he probably would have been a main event star in either of the two companies, because he could do everything, in my opinion.
Yeah, and he was definitely one of these guys that grew up as a fan of the business. And, gee, it's not a shocking coincidence that the guys that grow up as fans of the business end up being the guys that are the best, you know, best workers, the best wrestlers. And these guys that get into it as a way to make a living or just a means to an end, isn't it shocking how they don't always end up being the best performers? Go figure. Also, 16 years ago, Wahoo McDaniel, the guy that is always mentioned as the sort of the demarcation line. Are you a Hall of Famer? Are you better or worse than Wahoo McDaniel? That was one thing that Dave used to use, the Wahoo McDaniel Dick Murdoch standard. What, did you have a better career than Wahoo or Dick Murdoch? And if you didn't, you know, you weren't in. If you did, you were in. But Wahoo, just a legendary tough guy. One of those guys you hear just crazy stories about, not only the stuff physically that he would do, where he would, what was the story? Have you ever heard the story where he jogged like back to Oklahoma City or something like that? And it was like a 7-mile jog, and he just did it barefooted on a whim, you know, but just one of these freak athletes that could just seem, he was like a scratch golfer, for God's sakes, and just an incredible athlete. And one of those guys that if he had ever got a short run, you know, like when Tommy Rich got the belt for, you know, whatever, what was it, 2 weeks or something like that, a guy like Wahoo McDaniel, I would have had no problem if they had given him the strap for a couple of weeks just to sort of pay homage to what he brought to the industry. He was a guy that convinced so many people to get into the pro wrestling business because they ran across him, and he was making so much more money than he made when he was playing in the AFL. So last guy that I want to bring up and remember, we don't have a specific date, but April of 1982, we lost Pak Song, or as Gary Hart used to call him, Pak Song Nam. So it's been 36 years, Barry. Good Lord. And Barry, I know that you've had a chance to do a little quick research on Pak Song and talk about the memories we have of Pak Song in Florida.
Yeah, Pak Song, the Korean from Korea, baby. I used to love when Dusty Rhodes used to say that, but Pak Song was great. So I will tell you, as a heel, he's got to be one of the greatest heels ever in professional wrestling. And partly he doesn't get recognized because, A, his career in this country was over by 80 or 81. He went back to Korea. He was very sick, too. I don't know. So he worked Florida. He left Florida in 79. I believe he went to Texas. And there are photos of him, and I have this photo, and it's one of the last photos taken. Gary Hart's managing him in Texas, and he looks terrible. He's got these bags underneath his eyes. He's gray in his skin. He just looks really ill. He went back to Korea and just passed away within a year or two, but severe diabetes. But he was a really gentle guy, and I got to meet him once, and, you know, through my father's friendship with certain wrestlers, we had driven Pak Song from the airport to the matches at the convention center, and he didn't speak a lot of English. He could speak, you know, I guess a little bit, but he would do a lot of gestures. And when he got in the car, he sat in the front seat, and I actually sat in the back seat. And, you know, he had a huge head, which obviously, if you've ever seen a Pak Song match, he had a huge head. But at the same time, he was fairly tall. He was 6'4", 6'5". So he got in the car, and it was a Cadillac my dad was driving. And he had to kind of scoot in, and he looked up at the roof of the car, and he made the claw gesture and smiled. And I never forgot that. Even to this day, I can picture him doing that when he, you know, and that was like, how fucking cool when you're like a 14-year-old kid that you got Pak Song going to give the roof of your car the claw. You know, so how important is he to professional wrestling? everybody says, you know, when it comes to Hulk Hogan, just how important was Roddy Piper. And, you know, without him, would he have been the same? It's the same thing, because Pac Song is the guy that turned Dusty Rhodes babyface. I mean, essentially the fans did it, but at the same time, this was the catalyst for the babyface turn of the biggest babyface of the 1970s and even in the early 80s, Dusty Rhodes. So, you know, he was such a good heel. You know, and I've always been kind of intrigued. He actually worked as a babyface in the Amarillo territory and the LA territory. And I think both were heel turns that he turned into a babyface, but I would have loved to have seen him as a babyface. But we saw him, what do we see him? 4 runs in Florida? So he showed up, actually in 72 for maybe a month at best with Paul Jones. And Paul Jones brought him in. And this was when Paul Jones was the top heel in the state. And we're going to be talking about Paul. And it was the whole karate thing where Paul was doing the karate thrust, and they brought in Pac Song Nam. I guess he had been kind of a disciple of Paul Jones. And then Pac Song came back about a year and a half later, and this was the epic whole thing with Gary Hart and Dusty Rhodes. And, you know, Pac Song at this point was just, you know, he was the number one heel in the state. He left again, came back in 76. This time he came in with Rock Hunter, also became the Florida heavyweight champion. Then he left, and then he came back a few years later, which was around 79, and was part of the Sonny King organization. And what a group of heels. It may have been the greatest and most prolific group of heels ever put together. It was Sonny King, King Curtis, Don Morocco, Ox Baker, Joe LeDuc, Pac Song, and I know I'm forgetting one or two other guys, but you talk about a who's who of heels. Oh, my God, what a group that is. So Pac Song, to me, was fantastic. You know, a real nice guy, real gentle outside the ring, apparently a real family man. And, you know, the entire time he was in the U.S., it was to make money to send back to his family in Korea. So he wasn't a guy that was out getting drunk every night or, you know, smoking a lot of weed or anything like that. It was really just a guy that was going out trying to make money to send back to his family. And, you know, ultimate respect for a guy like that, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're spot on when you talk about the influence that Pac Song had, especially on the CWF rings, you know, as being the catalyst for the turn of Dusty Rhodes, probably not getting enough credit for that either. You know, so many people associated with Gary Hart and other people, but, you know, Pac Song was the guy that that served as the foil for the babyface turn of Dusty Rhodes. So we salute his memory some 36 years after his passing. Okay, Barry, time to get, we're back to my top 100, folks. We went off the top 100 for a while, gave some people the opportunity to send in their thoughts as to what matches I missed. We had a chance to talk about those. So now we're back, and we're going to give you guys a special treat. We're giving you two of the matches today. We're going to talk about two matches, but both of them are in my top 20, Barry, a special gift to the audience. I'm nothing if not giving here. We are going to April 2nd, 1989, my number 13 match of the decade from New Orleans, Louisiana, in the Superdome. Ric Flair chases the NWA World Champion Ricky Steamboat. Barry, tell me what you thought.
Oh, the match sucked. It's, you know, just the biggest.
They had horrible matches.
They had horrible matches together. So, you know, what are you going to say about when you talk about a Flair Steamboat match? Because, you know, this has taken on like mythological proportions, the whole trilogy, and even, you know, some of their other matches that had taken place prior. But you put these two together, and these two have said this many times, and they were doing a tour. They were in where were they? They were up here in Bethlehem, I guess, a year and a half ago, and I didn't go. But they've actually done a few shows together, and every time they do a show, they basically say there was some sort of magic when these two got together. It just naturally happened, you know, and that makes sense. You know, certain guys are going to be better working with other guys. So it's an incredible match. And, you know, Steamboat's gone on record with this too, saying that he felt this was the best match of the three of the trilogy. This is the second match, and this is the one where he's basically defending the title. It's a 2 out of 3 fall match taking place in New Orleans. This actually went head to head with WrestleMania 5, if I'm correct. And to me, you know, this was one of those gambles. This was just before, I believe, you know, the takeover had occurred. But this is one of those things that it was a gamble putting it up against WrestleMania 5, and it failed. They drew in that building like 5,500 fans. I forget what the number was, but I know it was over between 5,000 and 6,000. So you talk about a match that, you know, you watch this match, and this is, and I've said this before about other matches, this is a blueprint for greatness right here. You know, if you want to see how a professional wrestling match is constructed and how it's, you know, how it's actually made, this is a professional wrestling match. And, you know, to draw 5,300, whatever that number was, is a real shame. But, you know, again, Steamboat's gone on record saying it's his favorite of the three. Flair's gone on record saying it's his least favorite of the three. And I think partly the reason Flair has said that was he was really getting cheered in this building. And he felt that it takes away a little bit from it. Steamboat has kind of acknowledged that, you know, in a lot of ways, the way he was presented as a family man, and I think he's even said, used the phrase howdy doody, was a mistake in hindsight, you know. And this is the match where he brings little Richie out, and Richie's wearing the dragon outfit, and Bonnie's there in a prom dress, or what looks like a prom dress. And, you know, the crowd immediately, here you've got Flair coming out dressed to the nines with all these hot chicks all over him. And then you got this guy with his wife wearing a prom dress. So who are the fans going to choose? So, it is interesting to me, you know, to even think about, you know, the ramifications of this match. But this is such a good match, and there's not much I can say. It's a three-fall match. I do like the fact the way it was constructed where Flair wins the first fall. You know, I hate the defending champion wins the first fall, loses the second, then wins the third fall. And it's like we've seen that before. So I like this. Flair wins the first, Steamboat wins the second, and then you've got the third fall. And this match goes almost an hour. So it's 54, 55 minutes. So it's, you know, you're primed for the draw on this. And no, it doesn't happen. It's like a double chicken wing. They both fall on the mat. The referee counts three. From my vantage point, and I'm sure this is what was intended, it looks like everybody's shoulders are on the mat, but he counts to three and he gives the match to Steamboat. It's a great match. You know, this is what I think is cool about the Flair Steamboat stuff too, is you never want to watch just one match. You want to do all three of these because what you're seeing is something really, really unique. And so, and I wanted to just throw this in there as well. I did a little research on Steamboat, and God knows, you know, I've met him, I've talked to him 100 times. So, but I pulled this up and it was like Steamboat's never worked heel, and he never worked as a heel. And he goes, you know, I've been in the business now 15, 16, 17 years. I've always been a good guy. I've never been a baby face. And before I retire at some point, I'd like to be able to put on a mask or a full body suit and to go out there and I'll do punches. I won't do my chops. I won't do my dives, no cross bodies. I won't even do the arm drags that I'm known for. Just let me go out there. And Patterson looked at him and goes, you know, I could give you a chainsaw and you could go out there and cut the arms off of Hulk Hogan, and fans are still going to cheer you and figure out that Hogan somehow deserved it. So it was interesting that Steamboat wanted to work as a heel, and he never got the shot.
Yeah, this is here's the thing. As I started watching the match, it's really obvious that, you know, one of the things when I think, you know, people ask me, why was this match number 13 on your list as opposed to the one in Chicago, the one in Nashville? And I can't help to think, with the benefit of reflection and looking at the match yesterday, that the crowd And the lack of the crowd and the lack of the emotion from the crowd really, I think, played into my mindset, because, you know, the crowd in other matches these two had were so hot. And the other match that we're going to talk about today, the difference in the intensity of the crowd and the ebb and flow of the crowd in the second match as opposed to this one. And that really, you know, took away from this match, because there's nothing really wrong with this match at all. Except there's a real lack of emotion, and there's a lack of the crowd letting itself being taken in. And maybe if there had been, you know, 10,000 more people, first of all, the way the promotion was doing at that point to have the match in the Superdome was completely ridiculous, because you're now, you know, it's like you're this little tiny thing in this huge giant barn. I mean, if they'd had it at the Civic Center or something, like, I think there's a Civic Center in New Orleans, or just the local arena, you know, that maybe holds 13,000 people, and having 5,000 people or 6,000 people in a 13,000 seat arena as opposed to a 75,000 seat arena acoustically could have made all the difference in the world, especially if the crowd reacted to how good this match was. So you got Flair coming out. He's got the hair and robe. He looks great as always. Steamboat comes out with the kid and the wife. And I wrote down Ugg, because you're absolutely right. That just, you know, it's just a killer for a baby face. And yeah, Terry Funk is on the color commentary of this match. He mentions for the record that he's not retired, which I thought was a nice little bit of foreshadowing. It was nice for Terry to mention guys like Luthez, Gene Kaniski, Buddy Rogers. You know, they were all in the building that night to watch the match. So the match starts off and Steamboat slaps Flair right across the face, and he gives him a nice little potato, and Flair, you know, responds eventually. I tell you, one of the things I really liked and I noted about the way that Steamboat sold Flair's chops is, instead of just doing the, you know, the Luger bit where you act like you're kind of, dare I say, hulking up, or the way that Road Warrior Hawk would do, Steamboat kind of like cringes in a way where he brings his arm, he tucks his arms in, and he's really selling the effect that the chops are having on him. And he's every bit as cut as some of these other guys, but he's really showing the impact these chops are having on him. And I really like that. I noticed that Linda Rufa was the photographer at ringside. She covered the matches for the Japanese magazines, and she was always there for the big matches. There was an interesting spot where Ricky has Flair in a front face lock, and they're both on the mat. And Ricky, to sell the move, starts doing a headstand as he has Flair in the front face lock. And then he'd fall back to the mat and cinch up on the hold. And I don't think I'd ever seen anyone do that maneuver like that. And I thought that was kind of interesting. I thought it was interesting. They mentioned that they have matches. They had a match with Sting and a match with Luger. You know, here you got this match where you're competing against WrestleMania, and for some reason Sting is facing Jack Victory, which I thought was a little bit underwhelming. But they mentioned these are standby matches, you know, which is kind of interesting, because they're selling the fact that this match, again, is you know, we joked about, was it Rod Trongarn, who during the Henning Bockwinkle match turned to his partner and said, you ready to go 60 here?
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about the fact that there are standby matches, sort of like it was a little heads up that this match is going to go a while. So, I thought it was interesting. Funk mentioned that this match is for the NWA title, and it's not only for the NWA world. This is the most important title in wrestling. You know, Terry definitely putting things over. So the first fall goes 19 minutes, 33 seconds. Flair with the inside reverse cradle catches Steamboat. And, you know, here's something else I noticed. Have you ever noticed in every single Ric Flair match you ever saw, there's always a spot where something happens and Rick takes a bump and begins selling the leg, and he begins limping. And then after the match is over, he would complete the selling, you know, every bit the professional. He would work that leg injury all the way back to the dressing room. And it was just something, one of those things. They do a spot where Steamboat does, I counted, almost 15 elbow drops onto Flair's knee and upper thigh. And it was just, you know, that was one moment where I thought the crowd actually kind of popped as they began the count. But then the funny thing is he goes and gets Flair in a pinning position. They go 1-2, and the camera cuts to a crowd shot. I'm like, you're doing a pinning situation and you're cutting away to the crowd. The hell's up with that? They do a close up on Flair as he's over by the ring ropes. And again, Rick, ever the professional, looks towards the camera and he goes, "Oh God." just completely selling that that Steamboat's got him. And I thought that was a really effective use of the close-up. The second fall, Steamboat gets it 34 minutes and 14 seconds in with the double chicken wing, which is kind of interesting because that's the move that everyone hated when Bob Backlund did it. But they had Ricky Steamboat use that as his finishing maneuver. Yeah, I wanted to ask you something. You know, I watched this, and of course, this is now property of the WWE because, of course, they you know, bought all the WCW stuff. But, you know, here on the screen, you see the image of TBS, and it struck me kind of curious as to whether or not when they did all the purchasing, did the WWE, when they purchased WCW, did they have to also purchase the ability to use the TBS image? I have no idea the answer to that, but that just suddenly popped into my head. Terry Funk says at some point when they start getting around the 45-minute mark that both men are saying to themselves, I'm not going to be the one that's going to quit. And, you know, Flair is getting after Steamboat at one point towards the end of the match. And Funk says, Flair smells it. He's like a dog on Steamboat at this point. And he's just continues to chop. He's going for one. Here's the spot. How many times have you seen a Ric Flair match where Ric Flair does the flip into the corner, runs over to the other corner, gets to the top rope, he jumps off, and he's inevitably hit with a clothesline or a chop or a shot to the stomach. He takes the bump. In this match, he actually hits the cross body from the top rope. And I was like sitting there thinking, I think that's the first time I've actually seen Ric Flair hit that move from the top rope. And Terry Funk, very interesting, says, at this point, Steamboat has to be thinking that a draw is just as good as a win because he keeps the title. Let's see. Steamboat is glazed over, Funk says, at the end. But they will not quit. Finally, we go, I believe you're right, Barry, it was 54 minutes, 55 minutes in that area. The double chicken wing, he takes him down again, both shoulders down. And, of course, this was the inevitable setup for the Nashville match. So, Barry, let me ask you, is this a top 20 match of the decade?
Absolutely. I would absolutely say it is, too. I think if you take out the fact that the crowd is not fully vested does hurt it a little bit. But what's taking place inside the ring, literally, it's magic. I would say it's a top 20. If it's not a top 20, it's right there. You know, for me, I'm into. If I can tell you it's top 20 today and tomorrow I could say, yeah, it's a top 30, whatever it is. But this match is fantastic.
So I'm going to say this match was rated too high. I think it belongs top 20, but I want to say more 19 to 20-ish because
instead
I really
want
no. You're absolutely spot on. Inside the ring, what happens is tremendous. But I'm sorry, as I watched this match, I was just amazed at how, you know, first of all, you have this match. Again, they held it in the wrong building. If they had put this match in Greensboro or Charlotte, they would have sold the joint out. And the crowd would have been so much more emotionally invested. They had zero history in New Orleans. It's not their fault, you know, that they're in a building where people really don't care about the feud, obviously, that 5,000 people showed up to see this match. But sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Do you know who Flair also blames for this match? Besides the fact that the crowd, but do you know why he thinks the crowd was taken out of this match?
Give me the answer.
It's Bonnie Steamboat. So apparently Bonnie and Flair never got along. They never liked each other. And Flair's been really, really critical of her. And I have to agree with him on that, too. And he said that she really insisted on coming out with Ricky, that it wasn't like it was Ricky's idea, that it was Bonnie's idea. And he kind of went along with it. So she insisted on coming out. And Flair makes this comparison that Bonnie Steamboat wanted to be Miss Elizabeth. And, you know, I there's a lot of jokes to that, but at the same time, Bonnie was not prepared. At least Miss Elizabeth had some sort of wrestling mindset, and Bonnie Steamboat did not. Flair's always said that Bonnie completely disrupted Ricky's career, and he's been extremely vocal about it. So I don't know how Ricky feels about that. I know that they're divorced for years, but it's a shame because she wasn't needed there. And I can understand wanting to have your son there. And I know that Steamboat also looks back at that. And he's kind of got that Kodak moment where, you know, my two-year-old son in one of my biggest matches, he's there. I'm so proud of him. At the same time, Bonnie Steamboat did not need to be there.
Yeah, no, I tell you, I can't really find any disagreement with that because it's completely, you didn't have a baby face. As good as he was in the ring, he was not a baby face that had been invested. The crowd was not invested with Ricky Steamboat at this point. Even dare I say, much less the way that they were 10 years ago in the Mid-Atlantic region, or even like in 85 or 86. Early 87 in the WWE, the way that, you know, after the angle with Savage, where they did the ring bell across the throat, the way that Steamboat had brought the fans in and, you know, the support that he got by this point, especially in a town like New Orleans that they had no stinking history in. It's again, whether you blame Bonnie Steamboat or Jim Herd or whoever decided to book the Clash of Champions in New Orleans, you know, that night against WrestleMania and a crowd that just seemed very passive. And which is crazy because New Orleans for Watts was such an incredible town, especially when JYD was there. They were absolutely insane. You know, they tell stories about having to, you know, go out in the Jim Cornette and the guys would have to go out in the trunk of a car because the crowds were so hot in New Orleans. But let's face it, at this point, that time was past, you know. So anyway, again, inside the ring, absolute magic, you know, top 10. But I'm sorry, I'm taking points away for the crowd and for stinking Bonnie Steamboat. Thanks a lot, Bonnie. So, but no, this is a great match. I would put it somewhere lower in the top 20, but maybe not as high as I had it. So now let's move along. We're going to go to January 28th, 1986, my number six match of the decade. And Barry, I figured out as I was watching it this morning, I voted this as the best tag team match of the entire decade because my top five were all singles matches. We're talking Riki Choshu and Yoshiaki Yatsu versus whose boy, Jumbo Tsuruta and Jinichiro Tenryu. And by the way, at this point, I can now stop the podcast and say that we've mentioned Travis Reigns. We talked about Roadhouse, so that's a Swayze reference. And now we've mentioned Jumbo. Barry, you've hit all three of your buttons. So
I can go home. But I
yes,
can go
you
home,
can.
Exactly.
So yeah. Tell me what you thought about this match.
Oh, so this is another one. I absolutely hated it. I mean, how in God's name, if you've got Tsuruta, you've got Choshu, and you've got Yatsu, and I love Tenryu also, but I mean, you've got three of my four favorites right there, and so this is, yeah, this is a great match. What am I going to tell you? This is as good as it's going to get. It starts off Tsuruta versus Choshu, and there's a real, and I don't know what the backstory is with this, but Choshu's all taped up in his ribs. But this is an interesting match, and I'm going to tell you why, is Yatsu is almost completely on the offensive during this match, and Tsuruta is on the defensive, which is really not something that we normally see. Tenryu's on the offensive, Choshu's on the defensive. So something that you often talk about are finishers used as a transition maneuver. And at the 9.5-minute mark, Yatsu and Choshu give Tenryu the stuffed pile driver that looks like it could end someone's career. But to Tenryu's credit, within 2 minutes, he's up and he's wrestling again. But it is devastating to see it. This match breaks down. Tsuruta's battling Yatsu in the ring. Tenryu's fighting Choshu out of the ring. There is a spot where Tsuruta nails Yatsu with two consecutive clotheslines. It's unbelievable. Like, he gives him the first one. Yatsu somehow gets up. He gives him the second clothesline. And these aren't like, you know, and this is no offense to your boy BW, when he used to do that flying lariat that looked like it was partially connecting. These are stiff. Yatsu does a sling blade on Tsuruta, and I wasn't aware, and that's what it's called now. You know, the wrestlers like Seth Rollins and Finn Balor, Prince Devitt in the WWE utilize this, but I wasn't aware in 86 that, you know, the sling blade was being used, but Yatsu does it. Tsuruta is a bloody mess, and it's not a guy that bled all the time either, you know, but Tsuruta's a bloody mess. 26-minute mark, Yatsu has Tsuruta in the sharpshooter, whatever the hold is called in Japan, and Tenryu runs the ropes, and I think he runs them twice, hits Yatsu with a clothesline, and basically the force propels Shiruda pretty much through the ropes. He's like hanging on the ropes. To me, that was so cool to go that extra distance. You didn't just nail the guy with the clothesline. You're showing that the force almost threw you out of the ring. And that's just like wrestling psychology that you never see now. The finish comes. The finish wasn't as impactful, I guess, but the match itself is super impactful. But I'll tell you one thing that really struck out to me as I was watching this match. This is a wrestling match. And Jeff, I know that you have the WWE Network. Did you happen to watch this this spectacle that came from Jeddah in Saudi Arabia this past Friday?
Other than seeing Titus O'Neil slip on his way to the ring and go underneath the ring, no, I did not watch it.
Which was the greatest entrance in the history of professional wrestling. No one can ever top that. I don't think that could ever be topped.
There's a great meme that I saw that has the Shockmaster handing a some sort of torch to Titus O'Neil. That was very funny.
That is, and credit to whoever came up with that, because it really, that was the highlight of the show, by the way. But so as I watched the show, and it was, there was good, and there was nothing that was terrible, I guess, but it was like an episode of Raw for the most part. But The Undertaker wrestled in a casket match against Rusev. I don't know why this struck me like this, but it was, there's no back history between Rusev and The Undertaker. So to have them do a casket match literally makes no sense. Now, I know it's professional wrestling. There's not supposed to be a lot of sense being made to begin with, and I get that. But at the same time, it wasn't a wrestling match. It was an exhibition. And I remember this match that Lou Thesz had in All Japan 90, 91 against Masachono. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. I'm not surprised. Thesz was competing,
He was 70 something years old. But I remember they didn't bill it as a match. They billed it as an exhibition. And the truth was, that was more of a match than this Undertaker Rusev thing. And look, love Undertaker, don't whatever. It doesn't matter. This was guys. Undertaker was there just to make an appearance in Saudi Arabia. Is all it was. It was an exhibition. It wasn't a wrestling match. Then, right when this card ended, this card ended at like 4 o'clock that day, something like that. It was like 12 to 3:30, 12 to 4. I immediately watched this match, and this was the best thing I saw of that 4 hours. So it struck me that this is a wrestling match, and what we were watching, that other 4 hours, a lot of that was an exhibition. This match blew me away, though, in the performance. And I said this, and I knew I said this 2 or 3 months ago, Yoshiaki Yatsu doesn't get the credit that he deserves. This guy was really fucking good. Shiruda, obviously, I rave and, I wet my panties every week that we bring him up, because Shiruda, to me, he's just a fantastic wrestler. Choshu, Tenryu, these guys are incredible. This is incredible wrestling, but Yatsu doesn't get the credit he deserves. This guy was something special as well.
Yeah, this, just to give you a little bit of background on this feud, of course, I believe a year before, Choshu had jumped from New Japan over to All Japan, and it was something that was very rarely done. Yeah, you had Americans that were doing that, but for a Japanese guy and his group to jump from promotion to promotion, especially to a promotion that was very conservative, Baba's promotion, far more conservative than Inoki's group. So it was a real surprise, but it completely just elevated the promotion to where, if it wasn't better than New Japan, because New Japan was pretty great, but, it infused a new dynamic. You had new characters being introduced that created new drama. Choshu has always struck me. I'm going to give a comparison to two guys. I'm not going to do the Kevin Nash thing, by the way. I did that once. I remember you were like, please don't compare anyone to Kevin Nash. But he struck me as sort of a Japanese Flair or Shawn Michaels, in the sense that great performer in the ring and nothing can be taken away. But behind the scenes, a little bit of a shit stirrer. And he had that reputation. Much like the way that Flair, God bless him, had a reputation of being a bit of a drama queen behind the scenes, as did Shawn Michaels, of course, legendary for that. And that was incorporated into the matches, because the Japanese fans are, dare I say, more knowledgeable. I don't want to say smarter than American fans, but they are more in tune with what's going on, not only in the ring, but behind the scenes, because there's so much coverage. And, you know, there was, especially at this time. So as the match started, it was very interesting. The intros, they have these flags that they're carrying to the ring. It's almost like a nationalistic thing, you know, or like you see at a, I don't know, like a soccer match in England or Germany or Italy, just how like everybody has their own, they're the 50% of the crowd that's totally for Choshu and Yatsu. And there's 50% of the crowd that by God are there to support Saruta and Tenryu. And as they start off, I'm sitting there thinking, wow, the match starts off with Choshu and Saruta. You got two guys who are in the 72 Olympics, you know, Barry, it's, and you know, Choshu representing South Korea, Saruta for Japan. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, Barry, I reached out to you. Give me some timeline of, you know, this match is obviously 86, and I think he came back to All Japan around 82. I'm sorry, New Japan around 1982. What was the timeline that Ricky Choshu was in the state of Florida?
Yeah, so you and I have discussed this at fantastic lengths before. So I was really fortunate that I was able to see, you know, his entire run. He was a prelim guy. His name was Mitsu Yoshida, which I believe is his legitimate name. And he was in from January to August 1975. And he was a prelim guy. He was doing jobs on TV. He won a couple of matches, but, you know, for the most part, this was a job guy, as much as I hate actually using that term. And this was not a guy that got any sort of push in any form. And he had a cool look. You know, we were used, in the state of Florida, we were used to seeing Japanese wrestlers as heels. They were the stereotypical heel. They were barefoot. You know, they did the karate chops. They were always doing shit behind a ref's back. And then you got a guy who's kind of a little pudgy, had long black hair, which we had never really seen before like that, still barefoot, but he was a babyface. And even as a heel, and I don't know if he ever even technically even worked heel, even though he was, you know, he would face babyfaces at times, he wasn't your typical. He was a wrestler. So he was kind of unique, and I remembered him. And I remember when I found out that Ricky Choshu had been Mitsu Yoshida. I was like, oh, my God. I was like, wow. So we saw him in 75 for the better part of 7 to 8 months. You know, again, didn't leave a huge mark as far as wins, losses, or titles, or anything like that. But, you know, for me, it was like, wow, I got to see Ricky Choshu in his early days. So yeah, you know, he never came back, which was the sad thing. And kind of interesting too, Florida had this dynamic. We had guys coming from All Japan and we had guys coming from New Japan. So you would get your New Japan connection was obviously Hiro Matsuda. And then your All Japan connection were the Funk Brothers. But, you know, we could have at any given point, you could have somebody from New Japan on a card and somebody from All Japan, which was always really, really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely true. When I met Keiji Muto in Fort Lauderdale in 1986, I remember I was talking to him. I was actually showing him the Observer Who's Who that came out in 86. And I showed him a picture of Kuniaki Kobayashi. And I asked him, I said, is this a Baba guy or an Inoki guy? And he looks at me. And of course, you know, Muto was a New Japan guy. He looks at me and he goes, Baba. And that was like, that was just his curt response to my question about that. So anyway, getting back to the match. So Choshu comes in, he's got the ribs taped up from a previous angle where he had been attacked by Saruta and Tenryu and injured during a match. He grabs the house mic during the introductions. And from what I am told, because of course I really don't speak Japanese, what he says is, this is it. This is your one shot. I've got my ribs taped up. They're hurt. If you can't beat me tonight, you'll never beat me. And then he basically throws the mic aside and the crowd just pops huge. It's interesting to watch Saruta and Tenryu during this match basically play kind of subtle heels. And I've mentioned this before about Saruta. I mean, the guy was a national hero from competing in the Olympics, super, super over with the Japanese people. And to watch him play a little bit of a heel was kind of an interesting, you know, you talked about Ricky Steamboat had never got a chance to play a heel. And this was during this program, because the crowd was split 50-50, as I said, it gives you a chance to watch Jumbo and Tenryu. Tenryu later on would play more of an overt heel. But, you know, this was the first chance these guys are – they're almost kind of playing bullies, taking advantage of poor Choshu, who's smaller than them, by a pretty, you know, I want to say a good half ahead, shorter than them. But, you know, of course, works so solid. They work on his ribs throughout the match. One of the things, you know, when we talked about our tag team episode from a couple weeks ago, somebody had written on the page, well, what exactly makes a great tag team? Is it because they use tag team maneuvers, or is it just two single guys that are both big stars that team up and they're involved in great matches? And boy, I can tell you, Choshu and Yatsu were definitely, and I want to include Animal Hamaguchi, who was at ringside. Those guys used tag team maneuvers. They were, you know, you mentioned the spike pile driver where Choshu comes off the top rope. They were doing double suplexes, double back suplexes. They were doing all kind of double team maneuvers where they were combining as a tag team. And that's certainly an answer to that question. And that's the reason why I included those guys in my list of great tag teams. They do a lot of stuff where they get thrown out of the ring. There's a lot of brawling on the outside. You know, one of the things about Baba famously told Saruta a few years after this, when he was facing Misawa, he sent a note over saying to Saruta that you're going to lose tonight. He says, oh, you mean by a count out? He said, no, it's going to be a pin. Baba, as much as maybe any promoter, had a way of feeling the crowd and feeling the emotion of the crowd when he was deciding what the finish was going to be. So as you have, you know, the finish here that we talk about where kind of, you know, it's just not a super impactful finish, but that was the way that Baba read the crowd that night. And he, as maybe as much as any promoter in the history of wrestling, had a way of sitting there in the, you know, watching the card and watching the way the crowd was viscerally reacting to certain guys, to read the crowd and make a decision on what the finish of the match was going to be. You mentioned that Jumbo had some blood. This was not something that Baba used a lot of in his matches. So, you know, here again, a case where you have blood to match where it means something, because it's not something, you know, this is not, you know, Southwest Wrestling with John Boyd, where, you know, the opening two matches have blood. This is, you know, where it means something. And I want to mention, yeah, was the move you were talking about where you said that's the move that the WWE guys are using now? Are you talking about the slingshot suplex?
No, I'm sorry. What was that, Jeff?
When you were talking, I'm sorry, did I wake you up?
I just dozed off for a minute.
Yeah. I'm really compelling. I'm making a compelling argument here. The move you were talking about that the guys did, that you say even now the WWE guys are doing it,
it's a sling blade. It's kind of a lariat, but you follow him all the guy performing the lariat doesn't just hit him with a clothesline. He kind of hits him in the front and then goes to the back of him as well.
Okay. No, I thought you were talking about, because one of the things that happens is Tenryu uses the slingshot suplex, which is the move that Tully Blanchard made famous in the NWA. And I'd never seen that, you know, used in Japan. I thought that was kind of interesting. Let me see a couple other things. The tape is torn off of Choshu's ribs. And then they roll him into the corner. The tape is reapplied by his corner men. One of the things I really liked about this match was the way that they brought the crowd up and down. And the crowd had a very, you know, they talk about a match that has a slow build. And this match, at the very beginning, you know, it is slaps. You got the crowd popping for a slap. But about 15, 20 minutes in, the crowd has suddenly become emotionally invested in this match. And the last 7 or 8 minutes of this match, when there's a two count, when the guy kicks out, the crowd is exploding. And it was a masterful job by the guys in the ring of just slowly building to this finish, to where by the time the finish hits, the crowd is really popping, because again, you've got a 50-50 split. And it's so interesting to watch that, because there's nobody that's a overt heel and, you know, like 100% of the crowd is against them and they're 100% with the baby face. This is like watching a sporting event. I've used that term before. This is really like watching a sporting event where two teams are playing and you've got half the crowd with, you know, the home team and half the crowd that maybe has traveled in supporting the visitors. And it makes a really, really interesting, you know, compelling emotional reaction from the crowd. This match was for the international tag belts. I want to show that they showed the the belts at the end when they put the belts in, these are great looking belts, Barry. I don't know. Absolutely. You know, we talked about, you know, earlier we were talking with Brian before we started taping about how when Motoko Baba died, it was said that in her home was just tons and tons of All Japan memorabilia, including all the belts that they'd had with the promotion, all of Giant Baba's. He was well known for bringing these very elaborate robes. And I don't know whatever happened to these belts, but boy, these are some great looking belts.
You don't have Motoko Baba's address by any chance?
I had it, but I lost it. I'm sorry. Okay. So she gave it to me when she gave me the
plane over there. Absolutely.
Yeah, when she gave me the Funk Brothers t-shirts, yeah, here's my address. You know, call me. So, but so again, yeah. So let me ask you, is this the best tag team match of the decade, you think?
Oh man, I don't think so. But you know, it's certainly right there. We've seen some matches. You know, that's one thing is, in doing this podcast for the last 6 months, you know, a lot of stuff that I hadn't seen in a decade or two, we've been able to watch again. So we've seen some really incredible matches, and we watched that match with the Funk Brothers, 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago. That was kind of mind-blowing. So is this the best tag match of the decade? I don't know that it is. Is it in the top 10? I would imagine it probably is. It's really hard for me to say what's the best, you know?
I wonder if the previous match between these four guys that we discussed, the one that Terry Funk is reported to have called Dave Meltzer after seeing the match in Japan and saying, I just saw the greatest match I've ever seen in my life, that might have been a better match than this. So, these guys, they're like Flair and Steamboat. These four guys get in the ring with one another. You're not going to see a bad match, you know? So that being said, Barry, we're now going to transition and discuss the career of number one, Paul Jones. We lost Bruno Sammartino, Johnny Valiant. We discussed Motoko Baba. And unfortunately, I kind of feel like Paul Jones got a bit of the short shrift, from people, because Paul Jones had an incredible, incredible run and career. A lot of people remember Paul Jones only from his time in mid-80s when he was managing the guys like Pez Watley and Baron Von Raschke, you know, who was kind of at the end of his career. He was kind of managing the B group, the guys who were always feuding with Jimmy Valiant, who was at that point had already become kind of a cartoon character. That's the guy people associate Paul Jones with, not the guy that was the lead heel in Florida for so many years, feuding with Jack Briscoe, not the guy that came back in the late 70s as Mr. Florida, not the guy that had the great tag teams with Ricky Steamboat and guys like Nelson Royal in the late 60s. So Barry had a chance a few years back to actually sit down and do an interview with Paul Jones. So Barry probably knows as much about the career of Paul Jones as anybody. So Barry, I'm going to throw it to you, my friend, and tell us a little bit about the life and times of Paul Jones, number one.
Yeah, and you just said two things that kind of resonate with me. The first was Paul Jones is primarily going to be remembered as this kind of cartoonish manager in the late 80s for the Crockett promotion. And he was so much more than that. You know, Paul Jones was a guy that was the lead babyface, the first the lead heel, then the lead babyface in the state of Florida for over 2.5 years. And there are a few guys, you know, take out Dusty Rhodes, who obviously, or Jack Briscoe. These are not guys, this is not something that is typical, but you know, Paul Jones was the lead heel for a year and a half and then spent another year as the lead babyface. And he was a guy, we did great business in the state of Florida with him. And I'll go to my grave and I'll say, in my opinion, the matches between Paul Jones, Jack Briscoe, and Buddy Colt, and it can be any of those three, because there were periods where Jones was feuding with Colt and Briscoe and vice versa. They were all feuding with each other. These matches were the best and most realistic wrestling matches I ever saw. And I don't know if wrestling is even the word I should even throw in there, because, you know, some of these brawls between Jones and Colt were just bloodbaths, and they were, you know, just really going at it. But it definitely hurt. And I think primarily because Paul and I, I'll go back. So Paul and I, in November of 2003, when I had the old CWF Archives website, we did an interview, and I posted this in our Facebook group the day that he passed, and it was a great interview. And let me clearly state, it wasn't a great interview from my side. It was nothing I had done. It was fucking Paul Jones. This guy was gold. He was he had no filters. He was not playing any sort of political games. He, you know, if he didn't like you, he didn't like Bill Watts, he didn't like Dusty Rhodes, he didn't like Louis Tillett, he didn't like Mr. Clean that he had worked with. If he didn't like you, he would say, fuck that guy. And he, you know, it's everything that's popular in our culture right now, Paul Jones was doing 15 and 20 years ago. So he had a serious dislike for Dusty Rhodes and Watts and some of these other guys. And he would tell you, he would straight out would say it. And as we were doing this interview, and even midway through the interview, when Paul Jones is talking about the women that wanted to fuck him in the state of Florida and in Las Vegas, I'm thinking to myself, this guy's got a book right here. This is great. So I transcribed the interview. I read it. I said, this was a period, too, when wrestling books were fairly sanitized. You know, now you've got books where I think guys are a little more open and they're a little more honest, but you know, wrestling books 15 and 20 years ago were basically being published by the WWE. So there was they were sanitized to a certain degree. They weren't going to be fully honest. And I was like, I think I got something here. So a couple of days after I posted the interview and it got out there, I called Paul and I said, Paul, you know, great response to the interview. People really like it. Have you ever considered writing a book? And we talked for 10 minutes. And at the end of that conversation, we had committed to putting his life on paper. And I was really, really excited about it. I was working. It was a part-time thing for me where I was working on weekends. I was raising my son. My wife had a Monday through Friday job. So in my free time, and I actually had some free time, it was like, you know, I could do this book. So I was really jazzed. And Paul and I then spent, the next 4 months, maybe 5 months, talking 4 to 5 times per week, sometimes for 2 and 3 hours, and just discussing his life. Pardon me, I'm getting a little choked up, in his career. And he was really interesting. Again, there was no filter. And the cool thing about talking with Paul was he would tell you stories, and then he would say, hey, shut off the recorder for a minute. And then he would tell me another story, and I would sit there and go, holy shit, you did what? And he would tell me these stories, and he goes, you know, we can't put that in the book because I don't want to hurt so-and-so's feelings, you know. And this was a different level of basically of him having sex with wrestlers' wives and things like that. And he goes, yeah, I don't want to cause problems, you know, for them in a marriage or whatever it was. So I said, absolutely. But he did tell me a lot of stories as well. And so I recorded all these stories, and I had all these tapes, and the same time we were doing this interview, I got a phone call one day from my mother's best friend that basically said, you know, your mom's in really bad shape. And I was kind of caught off guard. I had talked to my mom. I knew she wasn't in the best of health. But at the same time, I didn't realize to what extent. She had basically, except for the phone calls she was having with me once per week, she had basically cut herself off and she was dying. And she was in her apartment. My mother's friend brought her to the hospital and said, you got to get down here. So I, without hesitation, I flew down to Florida. I spent a few days with my mom. She subsequently passed away, you know, with me being there for 3 days or so. And it threw me for a loop. I came back to where I was living, which was in New York City, right outside of New York City. And my wife and I made a decision. She was pregnant with our second child. So a lot of shit was going down, obviously, at this point. And we made the decision that I was going to accept a position at Universal Studios in Orlando. So my wife, who was working for NBC at the time at Rockefeller Center in a high-level exec position, wouldn't have to work any longer. My salary at Universal would cover us. So we made the decision, we're going to move down to Orlando. So at that point, I contacted Paul and I said, Paul, my apologies. I've got to put the book on hold. My mother passed away and I'm moving down to Florida. Unfortunately, I'm going to be working 50, 60 hours per week now. So I don't know how I can do the book, but at some point, I guess I would like to try to get this. And he was pretty understanding at the most part, for the most part. So we didn't really talk again. And then I saw him in 2005. So I saw him some, eight, nine months later, and this was at the Wrestle Reunion Fan Fest that was taking place in Tampa, where, you know, you were there and Howard Baum, Pete Lederberg, a bunch of people were there. It was a great time, fantastic time. And I saw Paul and I gave him, 7 chapters that I had done of the book. So what I had been doing was I had basically started writing the book. I had these 7 chapters done and I gave it to him and he read it and he said, "Wow, this is really, really good. Would you like to, can we do this? Can we get back into it?" And I said, "I would absolutely love to. You know, I have to apologize again. You know, it's just all this shit went down and I just couldn't devote my time to it." And the fact that I wasn't in touch made me feel kind of like an asshole. So I gave him that. We spoke once after that, and that was basically it. We never picked up, and I don't know. I don't know if Paul was pissed at me. I don't. I think he was that we never really did this. And when he passed, the first thing that went through my head was, "Wow, I really fucked up." Because it wasn't about me. It was about, this was somebody that was going, and Jeff, I've made this reference to you, and I haven't done it a lot actually on our podcast, but in private I've done it. Years ago when we did a newsletter called Chair Shots, which goes back 25 years, you wrote an article, and I never forgot this, and you told the story, and it was fried green tomatoes, which is probably, at this point we're referencing a chick flick, but at the same time, it was something about sharing the stories, because if we don't share the stories, they're lost forever. And with Paul Jones dying, we only got through the beginning part of his career, maybe up until the mid 60s or maybe late 60s at best. So a lot of that was lost, but this was somebody who had lived. Paul Jones, one of the things that I think I respected about him was he lived his life. This wasn't a guy that that was going to go town to town and then just go back to his hotel room. If there was an opportunity for hot chicks, beer, he was not a drug guy by any means. He was literally just beer, but he loved living his life. And that was such an important component of this book. So I was really bummed in the fact that, we'll never finish the book, but all of his stories are lost. Everything that was in the head of Paul Jones, and this was a fucking career, that it wasn't just the Carolinas and Florida. He was in Japan. He was in Texas. He was in Canada. He was in Los Angeles. He had traveled and he had seen so much, and he had basically, he was one of the guys that was running that South Atlantic Pro Wrestling promotion when he left Crockett. So he had done so much, and the fact that this was now lost. So immediately I start searching for these chapters of his book, and I don't find them, but I did find the hard drive that they're on. So I somehow have to extract these. When I do, I am going to post them. It's not something that I want to profit off of in any form or anything like that. I want to post this so that people can read it. And, you can understand he's a touching, the opening chapter. And that shit, it's been 15 years, so I have to jog my memory. But the opening chapter was basically Paul was facing, Paul had cancer at one point, and he and his wife had just gotten divorced. She had gotten remarried, and he's facing cancer, and he doesn't have a job. It's just he's kind of at a low point in his life, and he's writing it, and he's talking, and he's reflecting on his wrestling career, and he's telling this story about, almost getting knifed one night in Orlando. He was tag teaming with Bob Orton Jr. and Bob Orton Sr., and a fan came out of nowhere and had a knife and was coming directly for them, and he thought he was a goner. So he's kind of reflecting on how he's maybe looked at death in the eyes previously and faced these situations. But now he's facing cancer. So it was really kind of impactful. And at the same time, he's so honest about what he's done. And it wasn't, it wasn't kind of a bragging thing. It was kind of like, fuck it. I lived, man, and I'm going to tell you about what I did and stuff like that. So I really was sad when he was gone. And I was sad because I know that a lot of our listeners, I realize that every time I knock Shawn Michaels or Kevin Nash, there's always somebody, and they don't, they're not disagreeing, even though they love these guys, but they're basically referencing the fact that this was the wrestling that they grew up with. They grew up with, Shawn Michaels and Kevin Nash and Scott Hall. That was their Jack Briscoe and their Paul Jones. So, it bums me in that you'll never understand the greatness of Paul Jones. You'll see him as again, this buffoonish, kind of cartoonish manager, when this guy was fucking money. This guy was drawing on a nightly basis. He was drawing 4,000 and 5,000 fans who would come see him week after week after week. And that was the beauty of the territories. Miami, every Wednesday night without fail. Every single Wednesday night. They never took a Wednesday night off unless it fell on Christmas. Fort Lauderdale every Friday. Tampa every Tuesday. The same fans would come and pay money every single week. And it wasn't a question about new fans. It was the same people. So Paul Jones had this drawing ability. And obviously you couple that with the fact that, Eddie Graham was a master when it came to running a territory, but he was incredible. So we did leave people last week with a cliffhanger, and you knew the answer because you had dinner with Paul Jones once. And it was real funny because I remember when you told me, you go, I'm going to have dinner with Paul Jones next week or, in a couple of weeks. And I'm like, oh man, he's crazy. He's going to tell you this. And you walked out of that and you called me and you said, he was like a complete gentleman. I was like, wow, I must have gotten, I must have gotten the completely unhinged Paul Jones.
I'll tell you, Barry, real quick. The thing that I remember about the dinner that my friends and I had with Paul Jones is you had told us ahead of time, okay, you got to ply him with beers. You start giving him beers and he's going to start getting drunk and he's going to be uninhibited and he's going to trash everybody and tell great stories and you'll be laughing off your ass. The dinner starts. The waiter comes around. Can I get anyone something to drink? Paul, would you like a beer? No, thanks. And we all looked at one another like, shit. And I remember afterwards texting him. Yeah, I texted you, Barry. And I said, yeah, he didn't want any beer. And it was like we knew right then that we were doomed. So it was a fun dinner. He was not quite as, dare I say, open and eloquent as he probably was with you on the phone. He had this habit of you would ask him, oh, tell us about Jack Briscoe. And he would say, Jack Briscoe. Yeah, let me tell you a story. But he would have these dramatic pauses, and we were like, is he like thinking of something? Has he forgot what we're talking about? And, so we kind of left with a feeling that there could have been so much more. And I really wonder if Paul had taken us up on the offer and had a few beers that night, whether or not we would have got better stories out of him.
And it was funny, too. So whenever I would call Paul, Paul would essentially – we almost had – our first 5 minutes was almost the same conversation. I'd be like, so Paul, what are you doing right now? And he would say, yeah, I'm finishing my fourth beer and I'm frying up some bacon. And that was exactly what he would say to me every time. And I got to say, he would, so this is not safe for work coming up in about a second. So not that any of our show is ever safe for work, but so Paul would be a guy that could do a 180. So within a minute, I'd be like, so, so tell me this story about this time in Charlotte. And he would go, so I was getting a blowjob from this one girl, and then her friend showed up, and then I wound up getting a blowjob from two girls at once. And then, like, my son, who is two and a half at the time, would then come into the room, and I'd be like, and I would talk to him like a two-year-old, and Paul would say, let me say hi to your son. And then he would go into this mode of, like, "Hi, this is Paul." Like, he was this real gentle soul. He would flip it in 1 second, which I just always thought was really, really interesting. But so, Jeff, we never answered the question with the cliffhanger last week. And
yes. For the listeners, who is the woman, the famous musical performer who legend has it that Paul Jones took her virginity?
Absolutely. So there are three famous residents from Port Arthur, Texas, that I'm aware of. Paul Jones, the world famous wrestler, obviously. Jimmy Johnson, the former Miami Dolphins coach and obviously coach of a bunch of other teams. And one of the most legendary female rock and roll artists of all time, Jeff Baudrin. Give me that name.
Janis Joplin.
Janis Joplin, baby. So Paul started telling me this story, and we were, at the time, he had never made this public before, at least through media in any form. I'm sure he discussed it privately, but he took Janis Joplin's virginity. And, that was kind of, he told me that. I'm like, we can really center a lot of the book around this. And he went into great detail, and he was very, he liked Janis. He said Janis Joplin was nothing like the persona that people saw years later, when she adopted the Pearl thing. And, he said she was nothing like that at all. But he was very descriptive, and I don't mean in a sexually graphic way, but he said she had this, like, young girl's body, in a sense. She was 17, I believe, when he took her virginity, and he said she was very gentle. And in turn, Paul was a tough guy. Paul had been an amateur boxer, Golden Gloves boxer. He was very, very gentle with her, and he described the night that he deflowered her. And it was one of these where, and it wasn't sexually graphic. It wasn't like a porno movie. It was really nice, actually, because I got the impression that he generally cared for her. And in taking her virginity, pardon me, it meant a lot to him. And not just in the, I'll hang it on a wall as an award that I took her virginity. It was something that I think actually meant something in his life. And he was very, very, soft about it, which wasn't always the way that Paul was. So I fully believed him when he told me that he had taken her virginity. It made perfect sense. If you match it up, they were roughly the same age. I think they were a year apart, something like that. They had gone to the same school. I believed him. So I know that, I could go on forever when it comes to Paul Jones stories. And I just want to share one. And I know that we want to get into our next segment at some point too, because again, I can go on for 5 hours if I have to, but he shared with me an Andre the Giant story that I think I want to share. So this also will not be safe for work. And this would have made it in the book. And I should say, Jeff, at some point, if I can figure out a way to change the names, I would like to share some of the stories that he shared with me off air. I just don't want to, there's some good people and I don't want to see anybody get hurt. So I do want to change the names of the innocent to protect them. But an Andre the Giant story. He loved Andre. He considered Andre one of his best friends in the wrestling business. And he said whenever Andre came to the Carolinas, they always spend time together. They would spend the entire trip. They would drive town to town, whatever it took. So he was with Andre, and they were in a town in Virginia one night, and Paul had driven. And they get to the town, and they meet a couple of girls who are at the arena, and they decide to split off and go to the hotel. They're going to go out to a bar, and then I think go back to the hotel. So Paul is now going to drive one of the girls, but the other girl has her car and she'll drive Andre. Turns out it's a compact car. So the girl's in the driver's seat, and it's literally one of these really tiny cars. It's almost impossible for Andre to get in. So Paul and the other girl spend 15 minutes cramming Andre into this car. So Andre's in the car now. They get to the bar. They now have to spend 15 minutes getting Andre out of the car. Like, his legs will not come out. They get into the bar, and the girl, Andre is, I guess, getting drinks at the bar or something, and the girl looks over at Paul and says, I like your friend and everything, but is his dick going to be as big as the rest of him? And Paul, I guess, lets out this big, gigantic laugh and says, they don't call him the giant for nothing. So the girl's got this look on her face of, I guess, curiosity, but a little frightened. So they drink at the bar, whatever takes place. They wind up back in the hotel room, and they have rooms next to each other. So Paul's in the room with the one girl. Andre's in the room with the next girl. And I have to be careful because I'm in my basement right now. But Paul says, as he's nailing this one girl, all he can hear in the other room is, fuck me with that giant dick. Fuck me with that giant dick. And Paul said, even though he's in the middle of having sex, he's bursting out laughing and he's banging on the wall. And he's saying, Andre, put that giant dick away. Put that giant dick away. So, you know, hearing these stories, it was great. And it wasn't something that, I don't think Mick Foley's going to put a story like that in his book, you know?
When you sit there and started telling that story, I was thinking about a story that he told us at the dinner table about Andre and how Andre, I don't know if it was the same occurrence or if it was a different time, just with a similar situation, but Andre had wanted Paul to hook him up with one of the girls. And so they were leaving and Andre was going to go with the girl, and it was like a VW bug or something like that. And so they're trying to get Andre into the car so he can leave with this girl. And Paul said, all I was thinking at the time was, man, he must really want to get laid because he's going through all this effort to get into the woman's car. So
that is the same exact story, by the way. This is the rest of it. Yes.
It was
a VW bug.
Just before we finish up our Paul Jones things, I want to discuss two things with you. Sure. Number one, the Briscoe brothers played on Paul. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, absolutely. Too.
Okay.
So
tell that story about the rib that the Briscoes played on Paul when he was brought into Florida to meet Eddie Graham.
Yeah. So Jack Briscoe, so he had been friends with the Briscoe brothers from their time in the Carolinas, and Jack Briscoe called him up and said, hey, we want you to come down to the state of Florida. We're going to make you a top heel. How soon can you be down here? And according to Paul, he had never worked heel before. I believe he actually had in Los Angeles. But he had never had a long run as a heel. So he said, yeah, you know, Jack said, how soon can you get down here? And Paul Jones said, well, I'll do my best to get down there as quickly as possible. So the Briscoe brothers met him at the airport, and Paul shows up, and he had wrestled the night before. And shows up, you know, I think it's a Sunday morning, it's early, and he shows up in a suit and tie, and it's probably 100 degrees outside, and he's sweating, and the Briscoes look at him and go, Jones, can't believe you actually fell for this. So, you know, at that point, the Briscoes were trying to convince Paul that he had gotten ribbed, that they had brought him down, he wasn't going to be a top heel or anything like that, so they get in the car, they take him over to Eddie Graham's house, and they introduce him to Eddie Graham, and Eddie Graham turns around and looks at Paul Jones and says, Jones, what the fuck are you doing here? And at that point, Eddie Graham is laughing. So the Briscoe brothers and Graham had kind of done this whole rip on Jones to get him to Florida and then make him feel like, no, you're not going to be working here. But he did. You know, obviously he did. He wound up working the state of Florida. And you know, it's funny, in all the interviews I did with Paul, where he would either trash people, and he held few people in high regard. Pat Patterson was a guy that he really held in high regard. And we can talk about that at a future date. Jack Briscoe was someone that Paul put on a pedestal. He was, he considered him the greatest professional wrestler of all time, the greatest NWA World's Heavyweight Champion, and just a great guy. And then he would joke right after and goes, but that cheap son of a bitch, I still got to pay for all the beer. So I think there was this real respect between the two of them. But yeah, I love that story too.
The last thing about Paul that I want to ask you about, just because it slipped my mind at this point, Paul was involved in this very, I don't know if it was with Jack or not, that's why I bring it up now. Who was he in the situation with where Paul famously threw the belt off the bridge?
Yeah, Well, it was Jack, and it was Paul had, that's a hell of a story right there. And Paul, and he was the first one to ever do this too. Paul had won the Florida title, and, you know, he wound up throwing the belt off the Gandy Bridge in Tampa. And, it was such a big story locally. He had gone on television and basically said, I'm going to go to the Gandy Bridge, which is St. Petersburg, and I am going to go to the top of the bridge, and I'm going to throw this belt right in the water. And news stations, television cameras showed up, newspapers showed up. It was a major story the next day. And it was something that people were still talking about 10 and 15 years later. People still talk about it now. You know, you can go down to Tampa and somebody invariably is going to say, wonder if they ever found that belt off the Gandy Bridge. You know, and they never did, as far as I know. Because if they did, Bruce Owens would have it, you know. But yeah, it was, exactly. But it was great. And then we saw Paul one more time, and Paul came back in March of 1980. And he came back, and he came back as Mr. Florida. And he stuck around. It was only 5 months or so, and he stuck around. And he was. It was a big deal. And you know, and Paul was. He was very angry at Dusty. Paul felt that you know he was drawing huge houses. And history says Mr. Florida was drawing houses. You know, he was drawing some big numbers. And Dusty was not really around the state at this point. And Dusty left. Dusty came back basically at that point, cut the legs off of him, and had him lose a loser leave Florida. And then loser has to be unmasked match to the Super Destroyer. And that took place at the Last Tangle in Tampa. And he felt that was Dusty's undoing right there, that Dusty was the one that basically said, you know what, I want my spot back, and you're out of here, Jones. They never liked each other. They never got along. When Dusty went to Crockett, you know, there was a lot of heat there. They never saw eye to eye. And he kept his job. Paul kept his job there because of Crockett. Dusty wanted him gone. And Paul was very, very, very vocal about that. Just a tremendous talent. And, you know, again, for the most part, a regional talent. But at the same time, you know, if cable television had been around 10 and 15 years earlier, everybody would be mourning Paul Jones. And they should be.
And Paul, of course, just to finish up, was also involved under the guise of Mr. Florida. And the famous angle that I know is out there on YouTube where Oliver Humperdinck catches him in the eye with the lit cigar during the match with the was it Super Destroyer?
Yes, Super Destroyer.
Scott Irwin. And very famous.
They're all fucking gone. Yeah, they're all gone. Scott Irwin, Hump, and Jones now are all gone.
Yeah, so if you would join me, folks, at this moment, if you're so inclined, raise a beer for the great Paul Jones, number one. And we will, in fact, miss him. And Barry, I would encourage you, to, as I mentioned to you privately on the phone, get in touch with Scott Teal at Crowbar Press and see if you can't make some sort of agreement to get what you have in the Paul Jones story out there, because it needs to be shared and the memories need to be saved. Now, we're going to go a little bit lighter here. We're going to be talking about ice cream because Lord knows, I think Barry shares with me a love for ice cream. We're going to talk about our favorite retail locations to get a chain type of deal, to get a good scoop of ice cream or an ice cream cone. And then we're going to end off the show with personal favorite flavors, if you will. So Barry, why don't you offer up your top five places to get an ice cream cone or a good, you know, flavor of ice cream?
Absolutely, too, Jeff. So I hope that we have a little bit of time. I know that, you know, we're probably a good solid 90 minutes, 2 hours into this right now. But so when we started discussing this, and I'm real fortunate that I've been able to travel so much throughout this country, and generally, it's food. Food is my thing. You know, a lot of people, they travel. Jeff, certainly 30 years ago, if we traveled, we would want to visit the strip clubs in every city.
Now, wait a minute. I would never admit to that.
Not you. Not you, sure, but me and, yeah, but you were there too.
Howard Baum, he would admit to that.
But Howard would still be doing that. And that's the difference true. Is now is, you know, you and I are both in our 50s and we're both married. You know, I'm going on 2 decades this month. And the truth is I'm a much calmer person. So if I do travel and I travel a shitload, I look for food. I want to know where's the best pizza, where's the best sandwiches, where's the best ice cream, whatever it is. I want to know where it is. So I did compile my list, and hopefully you'll indulge me right here. But my number five pick comes from the Boston area. It is called J.P. Licks, and I know that we have some people in Boston. J.P. Licks is kind of the Boston ice cream. There are 12 locations. They have got some incredible flavors. Listen to this one, Cracker Jack. Lots of Cracker Jack, including the peanuts, laced into burnt caramel and molasses ice cream. Yeah, Jeff, you want me to say it again? How fucking good does that sound?
That sounds pretty damn good to me.
It's damn good. I was there. I was in Boston last August, and I tried that flavor, which blew me away. But my number one flavor was Cherry Garcia Para. So, yes, it's a take on Ben & Jerry's Cherry Garcia and Nomar Garcia Para that had played for the Boston Red Sox, 10, 15 years ago. So it's cherry vanilla ice cream loaded with cherries and then speckled with soft chocolate chips. Such an amazing flavor. I took one bite. I was like, I'm not going to eat lunch tomorrow, and I'm just going to come back and eat this. And I got to say, Ben & Jerry's actually sued the owner of J.P. Licks about 10 years ago based off of that flavor. But that is my number five pick because it just blew me away.
Sounds good. Okay, give me the rest of your top five, and then I'll offer up mine.
Oh, okay. Absolutely. So my next is going to be Springer's Ice Cream. And Springer's is located on the historical Jersey Shore. It's in a town called Stone Harbor. It's only open up certain times of the year because, the Jersey Shore obviously is a very seasonal area. So I want to say April, May probably goes till October at the very end, possibly November, because it's so popular. But it's a great place. The lines here are next level long. So I've been to Springer's, I'll say a dozen times, and every time I've been there, at a minimum, there's 50 people in line. At a maximum, there's 200. Now, normally, you would say, wait, there's 200 people in line to get ice cream. I'm getting the fuck out of here. This place is run like a business should be run. They've got 50 employees working behind the counters. And this is a huge area. So, they're well prepared. They're well stocked. Three flavors that I like that just, one is butterscotch brickle, banana peanut butter, and they've got one called emotionally nuts, which fits into my personality. And it's great. It is this rich, dark chocolate mixed with a milky lighter chocolate and then just a shitload of nuts tossed in there. And I love chocolate and nuts. So I love this place. My next is a place called Tyler's. So Tyler's is an ice cream place that I've been going to for about 10 years. There are three locations. It's all on the West Coast. It's in Bradenton, Cortez, and Longboat Key. So it's kind of in that Tampa, Sarasota area. Scott and Teal and I have debated about this. Scott Teal says it's the best ice cream he's ever had. I say it's my number three pick for ice cream, but it's great. 30 years. They do everything is homemade, which I like. I like the fact that they're making their own ice cream, but they do it in these micro batches. It's made in small 5-gallon quantities. And they do that to ensure a distinct taste and freshness, which I think is just, I think that's super cool that they're doing that. The staff is great here too. You can go to any of these locations. I've been to all three, and the staff is generally high school girls that are super friendly. You can try as much as you want. Great flavors, butter pecan, cherry vanilla. But the key here are the sundaes. They do these sundaes, and you can build your own, or you can get one of your own sundaes. And we get this brownie banana split sundae. They make their own brownies. You pick out three or four flavors of ice cream, two additional toppings, whipped cream, hot fudge, and then they sprinkle the top with waffle cone pieces. And it's something that we get and we just go, oh, my God, this is incredible. This is incredible. My number two pick, so this is where I give a shout-out to the lovely Zoe Jane Rose. She is my 13-year-old daughter, and she is, in our family, she is the true connoisseur of ice cream. And We vacation twice a year in Anna Maria Island. We spend 4 weeks out of the year there. And Anna Maria Island is this small little barrier island between Tampa and Sarasota. And we always go to Tyler's, but Zoe wanted to try somewhere new. So she did a lot of research. And I thought it was so cool. 12-year-old girl at that age doing this research. And she said, I want to try this place called Dips. And it's not the most creative name, Dips, I mean, for ice cream, but she goes, it's been voted the best ice cream on the island. Well, she was fucking 100% right. So we show up, and it's 9 o'clock at night. It's in a great location. We get our ice cream. We sit outside, and I take one bite of the ice cream, and I swear to God, Jesus comes down and touches me on the head. It was one of these moments when you'll never forget. I'll be 100 years old and on a respirator. Yeah, I'll be 100, but I'll be an old man on a respirator somewhere, and I'll be going, Dips ice cream. I'll never forget this moment. Lemon ricotta cheesecake with a raspberry swirl. Holy shit. It was incredible. I took a bite. I said, this may be the best ice cream I've ever had. And I made everybody in my family try it, and everybody said it was great. They do also do a salted caramel peanut butter that is unbelievable. I am thirsty as a mother when it's over, if I get that. But this lemon ricotta cheesecake with the raspberry swirl blew me away. My number one pick for ice cream. Jeff, can you guess the city I'm going to go to next?
Philadelphia?
No, it's not Philly. It's going to be Los Angeles.
Okay.
And it is a place called Mashty Malone's. It's in the Hollywood. It's right off of La Brea Avenue in Hollywood, California. So it doesn't hurt that it's within walking distance of an In-N-Out Burger. But when I was in L.A. last year, was my first time back in L.A. since 1986. And I lived there in 85 and 86. And I had not gone back in over 30 years. And it was a very cathartic experience for me because the last time I was there, I was 21 years old. I didn't give two shits about anything in the world. I was just, you know, I was a 21-year-old kid. And here I was now, a 53-year-old man back in my old stomping grounds. So I made it a point to go back to Mashty Malone's. And I hadn't been there in 32 years, but I had been there. So it's a really interesting ice cream place. The owner is from Iran. And he makes his own ice cream. He does it all right there in the store. And he does traditional flavors. So you can get your, you know, almond fudge or pistachio. And he does this Turkish coffee that is, it's just, you know, if you like coffee ice cream, and that's a polarizing flavor right there because some people don't. It's phenomenal. I mean, his ice cream is phenomenal. And part of it is, you know, he makes every batch by hand. He doesn't have people back there doing it for him, but he does these really unique flavors like saffron and rose water and cucumber. And I'm not the biggest fan of a lot of those kind of, you know, Middle Eastern flavors or boutique type of flavors. But I got to say the cucumber ice cream was really off the charts, so much that I got it 2 days in a row. But here was the kicker, what I thought was so cool about this. So I had dinner at In-N-Out Burger, and I walk into Mashty Malone's, and the owner's behind the counter, and I walk up to him, and I say, you know, I asked him, you're the owner? And he said, yeah. And I said, I just got to tell you, I haven't been here in 30 years, but I used to come here 4 times a week. I lived right around the corner. And I told him, you know, I lived right around the corner and I would come here 4 times a week, 3 times a week. And I did that for almost 2 years. And it's my first time back in over 30 years. And he looks at me and he goes, oh yeah, I remember you. Bull fucking shit, he remembers me. I mean, I had an afro. I was 20 pounds light. I don't look anything like I looked 30 years ago. But I just thought it was so cool that the owner goes, yeah, I remember you. And then he proceeds to start saying, I want you to try this, my friend. I want you to try this. And I sat there, and I must have tried 10 to 15 different ice cream flavors that night. I just thought that was like one of these moments that was so cool. So my number one pick, Mashty Malone's. The ice cream is phenomenal. The experience you get when you walk in there is kind of unique. It's not like anything else. I absolutely love it. I do want to give a shout out to a place that I did not choose. And it's called Toothsome Chocolate Emporium. It's at City Walk at Universal Studios. It is like a ice cream and dessert theme park. It's not the best ice cream I've ever had, though the milkshakes are fucking unbelievable. I had a peanut butter and jelly milkshake there over Christmas that I just thought was through the roof fantastic. But I gotta say, what's cool about this place, it's like the Willy Wonka Chocolate Factory. It's exactly what it's modeled after. And when you go into it, there's a whole area that is partitioned by glass, and you can watch people making the desserts. And as you wait for your table, and there's a full menu of food as well, because we also ate dinner there, and the food was really good also. But as you're watching and waiting for your table, you're watching them make these desserts, and realize this is a 600-seat restaurant. So at any given moment, you've got 20 people making 50 different desserts. So there was a girl in there making desserts, and she was super smoking hot. And my son, who was 16 at the time, almost 17, goes, "Dad, that chick's really hot." And I'm like, "I know, we should get a photo of her." So I pull out my phone and I go to take her photo, and she smiles at us and does this pose, like completely posing for the camera. So my son, who was with his friend, who's roughly the same age, sat there and stared at her for the next hour. But I'll post this photo because I just thought it was so cool. So a big shout out to them. But yeah, Jeff, Mashty Malone's with an Iranian-born owner is my number one ice cream pick in the U.S.
Well, now here's a prime example as to why you should talk to your co-host before the show, because I thought that we were going to do, like, you know, Carvel and a DQ. So you're sitting here giving your list, and I'm going, holy fuck, I got to scramble and come up with some names. And I got three. I got three. Thanks a lot, Barry. So let me first of all say, we talked about Cookout and the chain restaurants. My wife loves a good banana shake from Cookouts, so I'll throw them some love. Two locals that I have discovered recently. One, when I was up in Alpharetta, Georgia, visiting my daughter recently with my wife, she turned us on to this place called Jenny's. It's J-E-N-I-S. Apparently, Jenny's started in Ohio. They've recently begun expanding into different cities and different markets. I was very surprised to see that Jenny's now offers their ice cream in retail stores. We were able to, down here in South Florida, to find it in a Publix. And they only, you know, it's very limited right now. I think they had maybe four or five brands in the refrigerated or frozen section of the Publix. But in the store that we went to, my daughter said, "Oh, you got to try such and such a brand." She recommended the brown butter almond. And holy crap, that was a life changer, because when I found that in Publix, you think you're putting on weight. I had some blood work done yesterday. And when I have my visit with a doctor, I know he's going to go, "What the hell have you been doing?" And I'm going to say it's the damn brown butter almond ice cream from Jenny's, because it is absolutely amazing. Another place I want to talk to, last night we went out with our friends Will and Amanda here locally. And after dinner, by the way, Barry, we went to Maggiano's. I send you the picture, got no response, but I send you the picture. We went to a place locally. Barry, have you had a chance when you try your ice cream to try one of these nitrogen places?
I have. I did try a nitrogen place.
Yes. So there's a place local here in Parkland, Florida, called Sub-Zero. And the nitrogen, for those of you that have not seen this before, they basically they have the liquid ingredients. You know, they put in milk, and you can have it, you know, with the pure cream. You can have the low-fat milk. You can have the almond milk, you know, so it's vegan or whatever, however you'd like it. And then you just basically tell them. And the one that I selected was one called, I believe, Peanut Butter Bonds. And they have peanut butter with chunks of brownie. Oh, my God. And they make the waffle cones right there in front of you, because I got the thing. And I said, "Look, we're not driving home, because this waffle cone is not going to make it home. And the ice cream is going to melt because the waffle cone was still hot." So, yeah, if you haven't tried one of the nitrogen ice cream places, there's all kind of different ones out there. It's definitely something different, and it's definitely expanded my horizons. Number one, Barry, a place that I'm going to probably guess that you're familiar with here in South Florida, been around for, good Lord, I want to say 50 or 60 years now, and that's called Jackson's in Dania, Florida. Barry, did you ever go to Jackson's?
Jeff, that is a great choice. And if my memory was good, I would have included that on my – Jackson's is fantastic. The kitchen sink, for Christ's sake.
Yes. Jackson's is a place that was opened up, God, like late 50s, by a guy who passed away within the last couple of years. I can't remember his name now.
You're right. He just passed away.
And he opened up this store right along Federal Highway in Dania, Florida, between Hollywood and Fort Lauderdale. And he makes all his ice cream there. And you go in, and it's like a time warp. You walk into this ice cream shop from, God, like the 50s or 60s. They sell all this candy that you can't get anywhere else. And one of the fascinating things about this place is they have license plates from all 50 states going back years. There are license plates in there that are from like 1910, 1911, like that go back over 100 years, the license plates. It's just great memorabilia. And you watch them, you know, make the ice cream in front, or, you know, the ice cream that's been made there. They bring out to you that Barry mentioned. They've got a dish called the kitchen sink, and that's literally what it is. And, you know, they bring it in. It looks like it's about 2 pounds of ice cream, if not more. And if you can finish that, you've probably got some sort of eating disorder. That's all I'm going to say. So, but yeah, so that would be my choice. I think, Barry, you said if you hadn't forgotten it, would have been one of your top five. So, Barry, we're getting close, by God, to the 2 hour mark. So I think it's about time to wrap the show up, my friend. So any last closing thoughts from you?
Yeah, let's make it a 4 hour show. Let's just keep on going. We'll keep talking about food. So no, this has been a lot of fun too. And I want to give you credit too. And so this is a story, and I know I shared a little bit of this last week, but when Jeff originally was coming up with the idea to do this podcast, which is, you know, it's probably a month or two prior to the actual first episode, you were already telling me that at some point you wanted to do an Unsolved Mysteries podcast, and that you wanted to do an episode based off of that, which was clearly a day one vision that you had. And to see it come to fruition last week, to see the response, but the fact that it's, you know, to me, we can continue to do more of those, I think you should get some credit for that.
Well, I appreciate that. And I tell you, one of the things that was really gratifying was the messages I got from people who posted links to, you know, their own maybe local stories where, you know, there was some sort of a disappearance of a child or some person that had gone missing, and they never solved the mystery. I was looking up one today that Howard Baum, there's about his fourth mention, so he should be getting off on that, had posted about a woman in Macon, Georgia in the 50s. Who was the first woman in Georgia, I believe, ever to be charged with first degree. She like killed her whole family with arsenic poison. And I'm sitting there reading this. I'm going, holy crap, this is a completely awful story. But it was fascinating to see the way this woman did it. And that maybe that'll be a, you know, it's not the lighthearted top five ice cream joints type of story. But, you know, there's all these stories out there. I must have sitting on my next to my couch about references to about 12 to 15 different cases I want to look up and do an investigation on down the road, Barry. I think we're absolutely going to do that. Unfortunately, there are a few people that they want to get a heads up because they're not going to listen to that episode. But, you know, I think it's very compelling stuff. And someone even went as far as to ask me whether or not we would consider doing a true crime podcast. Barry, would you be down for that?
I absolutely would too. I had so much fun last week. And, you know, part of the thing is too, sometimes you and I get up here and, you know, a lot of this is either stored in our memory and we can just, you know, conversationally discuss it. At the same time, last week's episode did require, at least on my part, me having to look at these cases to understand them a little bit clearer. And then I find, especially with Alyssa Lamb, I had a general knowledge of it. But the next thing I know, I spent 2 hours, you know, looking at Alyssa Lamb online and going through that case. And it's really interesting. So I enjoyed. I'm 100% behind this.
All right. So folks, I would again encourage you, if you haven't done so already, to follow me at hashtag Bowder and Jeff on Twitter. Breaking Kayfabe, my book. I will tell you, Barry, the Bowder and the Booker book, I'm about 50 pages in to the getting it sent to our friend Scott Teal. So I am in fact working on it. I hope to have that done by the time and sent out to Scott by the time we go to Lutz, Florida for the big fan fest. I want to give a special shout out to Brian Last, the great Brian Last, the mothership. Good folks here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowder and Barry are in fact a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Folks, thank you very much. Want to mention, got a new board on Facebook for the Breaking Kayfabe site. Please don't go to the old board. Try to encourage yourself to go to the new Breaking Kayfabe with Bowder and Barry board. And until next week, have a good one, folks. We'll talk to you.